Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
The People's Army of Volunteers is ready. The firemen, the air raid wardens, the ambulance drivers.
Czechs, Poles, Norwegians, Dutch, and Belgians have joined the causes with our own.
It's the first time I was actually shot at. You could actually see the stuff coming at you. That wasn't frightening at all, of course. We saw it over so quickly. It was a bit of fun.
The Battle of Britain is about to begin.
Inside the Battle of Britain. From the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. The Battle of Britain conjures up potent images, fighter aces, aerial dogfights, heroes, and tragedy. The Royal Air Force's dashing fighter pilots, the bulletproof knights of the sky, risking it all to repel Adolf Hitler's Luftwaffe from the British Isles. Hitler's plans to negotiate Britain's surrender in June 1940 had been dashed, and now he intended for his birds of prey to swoop in for the kill. From the 10th of July until the 31st of October 1940, Great Britain's convoys, ports, RAF airfields, radar installations, and aircraft factories came under the attack of the Luftwaffe, who were trying to pave the way for a Nazi invasion of Britain. Much of continental Europe was already under Nazi occupation. The Germans expected Britain to fall easily, yet they failed. The Battle of Britain is celebrated as one of the most significant military victories in British history. But what was it actually like at the time? To mark the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Britain in 2020, the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund has created this series, telling the stories of those who fought and lived through a pivotal moment in history. I'm Victoria Taylor, a military historian specialising in British and German aviation. Together, we'll explore what it was like to experience the Battle of Britain, both for those in the skies and on the ground, at a time when Britain, to quote Winston Churchill, stared into the abyss of a new dark age. Episode 1. Escalation. It's early in the summer of 1940. Britain has been at war since the 3rd of September 1939, after Germany invaded Poland. The Nazi war machine has been sweeping across Europe at terrifying speed, engulfing Poland, Denmark, Norway, Belgium, Luxembourg, and France within a matter of months. Allied troops from these conquered nations, along with British and Commonwealth forces, are in full retreat on the continent. In late May, they find themselves cut off in northern France and at the mercy of Hitler's Wehrmacht. As the historian James Holland describes, the Nazi advance seemed unstoppable.
Denmark falls, Norway falls, and then on the 10th of May, Germany invades the Low Countries and France. France is rolled over, and the tiny British Expeditionary Force, which is operating alongside the French, has to fall back in line with its allies back to Dunkirk, and there is a retreat of Dunkirk. This is a strategic earthquake. You know, no one was expecting it. You know, Britain and France went into war expecting to win, expecting to be able to trump Germany, and suddenly the Germans are in the ascendancy, and it looks like after the fall of France in the third week of June 1940, that Britain is going to be next.
The war has come to Britain's borders.
This brings me to the great question of invasion from the air and of the impending struggle between the British and German air forces. It seems quite clear that no invasion on a scale beyond the capacity of our land forces to crush speedily, no invasion on a scale beyond that is likely to take place until our air force has been definitely overpowered. But the great question is, can we break Hitler's air weapons?
Winston Churchill had been Prime Minister of the War Ministry, Britain's wartime coalition government, for just over a month. On the 18th of June 1940, he gave his now famous Their Finest Hour speech in the House of Commons. It was later recorded for broadcast.
What General Weygand has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world will sink into the abyss of a new dark age. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
The stakes could not have been higher. Brian Considine was a young fighter pilot in the RAF. He served with 238 Squadron in Fighter Command's No. 10 Group during the battle.
Well, we were waiting for the invasion all the time, yes. We were on alert all the time for this invasion. We had confidence in the Navy, of course, but we knew it was going to be very tough, just living from day to day, really, I think. Realising we had our backs against the wall.
In early July 1940, the Luftwaffe's Commander-in-Chief, Hermann Göring, declared that it would take 2 weeks to soften up the RAF so they could launch Operation Sea Lion, the invasion of Britain. Having destroyed the RAF, the Luftwaffe and German Navy could join forces to hunt down the Royal Navy. The Luftwaffe had reduced famous historical cities like Warsaw and Rotterdam to rubble. Adrian Kerrison, a Second World War curator at the Imperial War Museum, says this kind of air warfare was new.
It was really the first military campaign that was fought almost entirely in the air. Germany had used its air force to pretty powerful effect in the Blitzkrieg campaigns in 1939 and 1940, so Poland, France, Belgium, etc. But this was mainly to support its ground offensive. And this was really the first time that a belligerent had attempted to destroy another belligerent's air force by air power alone, so it was really unprecedented.
Newly trained RAF fighter pilots Leslie Batt, Geoffrey Page and Brian Considine found themselves part of Britain's first line of defence.
Quite frankly, we didn't know what to expect. No one knew anything about actual fighting in the air.
Don't forget, we were all 19, 20, 21 years of age. We were just overgrown schoolboys. My first fight, we were sent off, six of us being half a squadron of flight. And as we climbed up, we received our instructions from the controller, who advised us that there were about 20 bombers coming in to attack a convoy, and that there were about 60 fighters up above them, acting as fighter escort. So we climbed up to attack the 60 escorting fighters. I suppose with hindsight, I should have been scared stupid, but I think I was so busy getting my aircraft ready, making sure the camera gun was switched on, making sure the safety button on the machine guns was on fire and not on safety.
It got more frightening the more you realised what was going on. One would be very, very tense, waiting to go up. We used to be on readiness when things hotted up. We used to be on readiness from before dawn until dusk. And you'd be lying there and you're waiting, you know, for the telephone to ring. Every time the telephone rang, you were, you know, all taut, waiting to go. And then you would run out and go.
So who exactly were these young men taking to the air to fight for Britain? Indeed, they were young. Their average age was just 20 years old, and the average age of the men who died was only 22. But as Adrian Kerrison tells us, our common perceptions of them aren't always accurate.
There's a myth that most pilots were posh and upper class. I think this has sort of been reinforced by Hollywood and popular culture. But in fact, only 200 of the roughly 2,500 British pilots in the battle had a public school background. And the good thing about the RAF was that it was quite advanced for its time. It was more of a meritocracy than the other services. So this sort of meant that almost anyone could be a fighter pilot if they could prove themselves.
Proving themselves meant undergoing at least 6 months of rigorous pilot training, consisting of about 150 hours flying time. As losses in the conflict mounted, training flying hours were trimmed, with some newly qualified RAF pilots having only 10 hours flying time on high-speed fighter aircraft. Equally, however, the Luftwaffe had to quickly train inexperienced bomber aircrews and fighter pilots to replace its own losses at Dunkirk. Nevertheless, the young men were supported by thousands of ground crew personnel who maintained their aircraft and air controllers who directed them in the battle. Many flew the latest fighter aircraft, the Hawker Hurricane, and, perhaps most memorably, the Supermarine Spitfire. The Hurricane was slower than the Luftwaffe's Messerschmitt Bf 109 fighter plane, but its agility helped it to secure the majority of the RAF's kills during the battle. The Spitfire, on the other hand, was more responsive. Faster and powerful, feared and admired in equal measure by the Germans. Whichever fighter plane the RAF pilots were equipped with, however, the young men were keen to take them into the air, as Ludwig Martel, Geoffrey Page and Brian Considine testify.
Flying a Spitfire, it was a dream which would come true. I thought there was nothing nicer at that time to be able to do than flying a Spitfire.
I was lucky because I had the unique experience of being one of the very few pilots during the Battle of Britain who had flown both the Hurricane and the Spitfire. I tend to give an example of the Bulldog and the Greyhound, the Hurricane being the Bulldog and the Greyhound being the Spitfire. What wonderful, tough working animal, and the other one's a sleek, fast dog. Three of us, we came on a Messerschmitt 110 over Portsmouth. But we found this one and shot it down, and then went straight into the water. It was faster than we were, 110. Of course, it had a heavier armament. It had those cannons and a rear gunner with his, but he was no problem. Of course, once you got behind a 110, he wasn't in the same league. It was the first time I was actually shot at. You could actually see the stuff coming at you. And because he was maneuvering and knew what was coming down on, it went round in a sort of curve past you. I remember that clearly. That wasn't frightening at all, of course. It was all over so quickly. It was a bit of fun.
In the earliest days of the Battle of Britain, from the beginning of July until mid-August, much of the aerial fighting took place over the English Channel. Twin-engine bombers from the Luftwaffe, along with the infamous Junkers 87 Stuka dive bomber, attacked British convoys and shipping in the Channel. They sunk ships carrying vital war supplies, particularly coal, in an attempt to starve the island of its resources. RAF fighters flew up to take them on in the air, whilst anti-aircraft batteries supported their attacks from the ground.
Combat report. Pilot Officer R. Berry. Green Bravo. 30th of July 1940. Bravo flight. 603 Squadron. Number of enemy aircraft. 1.
The combat reports the pilots wrote once they were back at base paint a vivid picture. Their words are read for us by RAF pilots serving with the Red Arrows display team.
Aircraft Green 1, one bandit heading southwest. I gave tally-ho at 2 o'clock, 16,000 feet. Green 1 followed enemy aircraft through cloud and carried out a number one attack. I followed with a number one attack and fired all my ammunition and broke away 20 yards from the enemy aircraft. When Green 1 attacked, enemy aircraft returned fire and dropped undercarriage. I experienced violent slipstream at 400 yards, opened fire at 250 yards, and the windscreen was covered in oil. Enemy aircraft turned west and crashed in sea in flames.
I did not see Green 1 and Green 3 and carried out head-on attack on JU-88, 2-second burst on meeting in cloud layer. He evaded me, and some 5 minutes later I sighted him below and dived out of the sun and carried out a prolonged number one attack. JU-88 was obviously in distress and disappeared in cloud. We found 3 men swimming in large patch of oil and a rubber boat alongside. We returned to base. Rounds fired, 2,510.
The Luftwaffe was trying to sort of draw the RAF away from home soil, over the sea, where it was more dangerous for them, because, of course, if you're bailing out, you're bailing out into the sea. It's very hard to pick up these pilots. You know, there were some very, very tough days. It was a battle of attrition. And whichever side could produce the most aircraft and produce the most pilots was going to win that particular battle. So it took its toll, and it was difficult and demanding, no question about it.
For those young and often inexperienced men in the air, life was dangerous, exciting, exhausting, confusing. And the battle in the skies was very real. For the thousands of ground crew working grueling hours on increasingly dangerous airfields targeted by the German bombers, this period was an intense test of their mettle. But for many civilians, especially those living outside the southeast of England, where most of the fighting was taking place, the Battle of Britain almost seemed like an epic war film.
Look, see the Spitfires above, 1, 2, 3.
Yes, I can see, well, yes.
Immediately below him, his best. He's going down his lane.
Many regarded the fighter pilots as their heroes. RAF veterans remember being cheered and thanked by civilians whenever they were out and about off duty. Even in areas near the Channel, where they could see the deadly impact of the dogfights overhead, civilians didn't always realise the danger.
What did happen, Blackie? Gun stop?
No, goofer trouble.
Goofer trouble? What's that?
Oh, you'll find out when you've been here longer. There's millions of goofers all over the country.
Sure, I've had them too, and believe me, they're a pain in the neck.
Yeah, but what is a goofer?
The Ministry of Information was so concerned about people endangering their lives and getting in the way of the battles by going out to watch the fight, they published a film warning people to stay indoors and to not be goofers.
Now, come on, give us a break. Back us up. Take shelter. And don't give us any more goofer trouble.
Goofer trouble was the least of their concerns. Things looked bleak for Britain. But what were the odds against her? The Luftwaffe had the offensive advantage of choosing when, where, and how it fought. And the RAF had to defend 600 miles, or 1,000 kilometres, of coastline. It is also often claimed that the RAF was horrendously outnumbered, yet it had 754 operational single-seat fighters to the Germans' 1,107. The historian James Holland says there were many more factors in Britain's favour.
The RAF has these huge advantages in that it's got home advantage, so that if someone gets shot down and they bail out okay, they can be flying again by 4 o'clock that afternoon. Whereas if you're in the Luftwaffe, once you're shot down over England, you know, for you, my friend, the war is over. There is also the fact that once the Germans are over Britain, they're on their own. Whereas our guys, guys in their Spitfires and Hurricanes, are constantly in touch with people on the ground who are updating them all the time with new information about the enemy and what's going on. And those advantages are absolutely colossal.
On top of that, although the RAF was outnumbered at the start, Britain was actually overtaking German aircraft production,
churning out double the number of their planes in July 1940 and repairing them faster too. And crucially, as I'll tell you more about in future episodes, poor German intelligence hindered the effectiveness with which their aircraft were deployed, particularly against the RAF's radar stations. But at that time, those odds weren't known to the many thousands of people who took on the might of the Nazi war machine, as the veteran pilot Geoffrey Page remembered.
You learnt the hard way. You saw an aeroplane with an iron cross marked on the side of it, and you attacked it, and through experience you learnt to hit it more often later on than miss it, as you did at the beginning.
In the next episode, The Hardest Day, we'll learn about how the RAF's success against the Luftwaffe waxed and waned during the Battle of Britain, delving into the intense fighting and immense toll it took on its personnel, both physically and emotionally. This series is a Chalk and Blade production, brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. It is co-written and presented by me, Victoria Taylor. The producer is Eva Krizyak, the mix and theme music are by Alex Port-Felix, and the executive producers are Laura Sheeta and Logan Armandoni. The oral history clips are courtesy of the Imperial War Museum. Recordings of Churchill's speeches are copyright of the BBC, and other original audio clips are courtesy of the BFI National Film Archive. The combat report extracts, which are held at the National Archives, were read by Red 1 Squadron Leader Martin Pert and Red 2 Flight Lieutenant Will Cambridge, who are serving pilots from the Royal Air Force Aerobatic Team, the Red Arrows. The historical consultant is Stuart Hadaway at the Royal Air Force Air Historical Branch.
This podcast is brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, the RAF's leading welfare charity. We are there for all members of the RAF family in their time of need, from those serving today to former members of the RAF, as well as their partners and dependent children. If you know of someone who might need some support, or to find out more, please visit our website, rafbf.org.